Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming back again. We've got several things happening here tonight. One, Tony's passing out a list of the high priests, something you're not going to want to miss. The high priests from right on here from 521 up until the time of Christ with a little bit of a definition about each one. We're going to review that first. She's also handing out a sheet of the battles of Alexander that we're going to take a look at. Tonight we're going to be doing the silent 400 years, kind of beginning with the close of the Old Testament in 430 when Malachi closed the Old Testament and beginning to come up to the time of Christ. A lot of things are happening. So a lot of history, a lot of details. I'm going to try and do an overview of it, kind of give you some information about it. I find it very interesting. The more you know about it, the more interesting it becomes. We have a lot of information recorded in history, if it be from the Greek historians or Roman historians or Josephus. So there's a lot of these details. Also, we're going to be mentioning Alexander the Great tonight, talking about him. And I'm passing around a coin of Alexander the Great, which is an authentic coin. It dates from the time of, it wasn't minted in the days of Alexander. It was minted later by the Grecian empires. Okay. Just pick out the people you don't like and give those to them. Maybe husbands and wives could team up or something, Tony, and share. And we're just going to be looking at it real quickly. But the Alexander coin, it's the bigger coin that's coming around. There's a coin about this size coming around, and it's a coin from 229 to 219 B.C., about 100 years after the time of Alexander, minted by Ptolemy the Fourth. And we'll mention Ptolemy the Fourth from Egypt here tonight. There's another coin coming out, a smaller coin, probably about, well, I'm going to hold this up, but I don't think you can see it, a fairly small coin. And that is a coin of Antiochus the Third, or Antiochus the Great, Mega. And that's from around the same time, about 223. But I just thought those would be interesting because we're getting to a place now where a lot of these things are historically recorded even on coins. On the back of that small coin, Antiochus III or Antiochus the Great, you can turn it over and you can see there's a war elephant because Alexander is going to face war elephants and the Greeks are going to be using war elephants. And it's going to be kind of a part of a new battle phase war technology that they'll have here this evening. Hopefully at the end of the night, we're going to go back to Daniel 11 and just read through the book of Daniel, or chapter 11, and kind of bring, you're going to see these things in prophecy, but I want to go through them first in details here tonight. Well, hey, let's start with prayer, and then we're going to start with the list of high priests and kind of just see how that goes. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus. We do thank you for the chance to be here. We thank you for your word, your truth that you presented to us. We thank that we have it in written form, but also that you revealed yourself in nature and including history. We ask that we may look at these things and understand them and make application in our own lives. Again, we thank you for the chance to be here, and I thank you for people that are here, believers in Jesus Christ who have the presence of the Spirit and are desiring to understand your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, very quickly, again, here on the chart, you can see you've got the name starting in 521 to 490. The high priest in Israel was Joshua. He's the one that came back from captivity with Zerubbabel. And there's his name. We kind of go right down the line just like this. A little bit in review of this, these priests right here, from Joshua down to Onias the Third, or Onias or Onias the Third, they're going to be the king, the priests leading up to the time of the one that we know as the forerunner of the Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth. And right in here is where things start. He's actually going to execute Onias right here, and Jason and Menelaus and Alcimus are going to be really some very poor high priests. They're going to be simply there for the money. So from Joshua to Onias, they're not all good high priests, but they're all fathers and sons or, you know, grandsons all coming in line here. At this point, 1, 2, 3, we've got some major corruption. Jason, Menelaus, and Alcimus. This is right in here is during the time of the Maccabean Revolt. Then we've got this period of 159 to 153 where there's really no understanding. No one really knows who the high priest was. It was right after the Maccabean Revolt. They just had cleansed the temple and got things back in order. So this wouldn't be anyone that we know that they've recorded. Then starting between this line here, say 153 up until 36, this would be Judas Maccabeus. We're going to be talking about him probably next week. He was one of the brothers that began the Maccabean Revolt. And along with Jonathan and Simeon are two of his brothers. And so they were from the priestly tribe, and they kind of took over, and their family now just comes right down through here. And these guys, as it develops, they became priests, but they also became the kings, the political leaders. A very dangerous time where you've got the priest and the king in the same position of power. And some of these guys were generals in their military, John Hyrcanus, other people, Alexander Janus, doing a lot of conquering in the Middle East there or around Israel. Then again, beginning right in here, you're going to have now Herod is king, and these guys are a couple of family lines that begin ruling and reigning as priests. And you can recognize some of these names here, including Caiaphas. Now we're in the New Testament. But let's go through this list right here and just get a little bit of a history about some of these guys. Again, these names, I know we're not going to remember the names, but I want you to kind of get a feel for the story of what's going on. But there are a couple names you're going to want to remember. Of course, Joshua, you should remember Joshua from the Bible. Jaddua, you're going to want to remember Jaddua. He's the one that's going to meet Alexander the Great. And then, of course, Onias the Third. Now, there's Onias the First, Onias the Second, and Onias the Third. Onias the Second is going to be very, very worthless. So this Onias here is the one you're going to want to remember. Then, of course, the evil priest, guys like Jason, Menelaus, and Alcimus, you're going to want to kind of know them. They're part of the story. But here we go. 521 to 490, Joshua was a high priest while Zerubbabel was governor. Zechariah spoke of him in the visions in the book of Zechariah, and he was active there. He's discussed in the book of Ezra. Following him is his son, Joachim. He was the high priest when Ezra read the law and signs the covenant with God in the book of Nehemiah. He was there standing with him, helping be part of the celebrations and the bringing the people back to the law. Then comes 470 to 433. All these priests, all the way down to Jaddua, right here, are all mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. Eliashib was closely associated with Tobiah, and he was the governor on the other side of the Jordan. Now, you remember they're bringing the foreigners into the temple area. They're there to make money. They're marrying foreign women. And he gave him a large room in the temple courts, and that's how the book of Nehemiah ends, with Eliashib having given a room to Tobiah and Nehemiah pulling the hair out of some people's heads for disobeying the covenants that they had established. When they built the wall in Nehemiah, Eliashib's home was in the wall, and it is used to kind of mark where one group was building and another group began to build, just so you know that. Joiada was one of his sons, one of Eliashib's sons, or excuse me, Joiada was one of the sons of Eliashib, but one of Jehoiada's sons, you remember this, his name was Manasseh. He married the daughter of the Samaritan governor and ends up going up there and starting the temple for the Samaritans. And it was a problem that the Jews faced back and forth, the conflict between the temple on Mount Gerizim and the temple on Mount in Jerusalem there by Mount Zion. It does say there, let's go to Jonathan. Jonathan, the next one, 410 to 371, was a wicked man, it says. He had a brother named, of course, Menelaus, who went north with the Samaritans. Also, he had a brother named Jesus, not the Jesus you know, of course. But this Jesus was promised to be receive the high priestly position by Artaxerxes II's general. And you can see his name right there, Bagoses. And when Jesus, one that's supposed to receive the high priestship, came in, his brother Jonathan had a fight with him in the temple courts and killed him to preserve himself as the high priest. So one of the sons goes to Samaria and builds the temple. One of the sons gets killed in the temple by his brother. And then, of course, the Persians then told him that they're going to tear the temple down and begin to charge a tribute. So you see, now the high priesthood has got some corruption going on in it. It's very obvious. But now his son, Jonathan's son, Jaddua, was the last high priest mentioned in the Old Testament, and he's going to come in contact with Alexander the Great tonight when we get to that story. Jaddua is going to come out and read to him. Alexander's going to say, I've seen you in a vision. God's got a message for me from you. And Jaddua says, and unrolls the book of Daniel and reads to him from the book of Daniel, letting Alexander know that what's about to take place is the goat is going to be conquering the ram. And Alexander sees it precisely as that, honors the Jews, goes to the temple and offers sacrifices as a Gentile could under the supervision of the priest. He couldn't operate as a Jew, but he could operate as a Gentile. He didn't desecrate the temple and gave him favor and moved on and destroyed Samaria right after that. So that's Jaddua. Then Onias, the first Onias, was the son of Jaddua. Followed him is Simon the First, known as the Just. He was the one of the first ones to write down some of the teachings that end up being put in the Mishnah. Now, you know, you've got the Old Testament, and then the Mishnah interpreted the Old Testament, or the first five books, the Talmud, and then after the Torah, and then the Talmud was written to explain the Mishnah. So see if I can do this. Torah, Mishnah, and Talmud. Now, you've heard all these words before, and you don't know what they mean, but the Torah is the first five books of the Bible. The Mishnah is a commentary of these teachers explaining the Torah. A lot of it was oral tradition, the Mishnah. And this one right here, Simon the Just, the first, is the one who, his teachings were some of the first ones to go in the Mishnah. Then later on, the Mishnah needed to be explained, and they wrote the Talmud to explain the Mishnah. So it's like having a commentary on the Bible, but needing to have a commentary explain the commentary that explains the Bible. And you can kind of see this is where a lot of the things, when Jesus is teaching and stuff, he's dealing with a lot of this stuff, and he keeps leading people back to the Torah, the Word of God, and they've already begun their traditions. It'd be like taking in, you know, every time you teach something, you're writing it down and spending more time focusing on what the teacher's teaching than actually what they're trying to focus you on. And this becomes a problem even in the church age, during the age of the scholasticism in the Middle Ages, where all they did was study the teachings of previous teachers and neglected the Word of God. But nonetheless, the mission, it's all a good thing here, but it can become a problem. Anyway, Simon the First, or the Just, was his teachings are in the Mishnah. He was one of the first great rabbis, and was the president of the Sanhedrin. During his reign, we're going to see people are starting to go towards the Grecian culture. Following him was Eleazar, another son of Onias the First. He is the one in 260 to 245 requested that the Hebrew Scriptures be translated into the Greek, or the Greek Septuagint. So you see the Greek culture is coming, and it's so predominant by this time that they need the Bible in Greek so that the people can understand it. And remember, in Nehemiah and Ezra's day, when they read it in Hebrew, the scribes had to translate it into Aramaic so that they could understand it, and then they taught it to them, and they began to create the Mishnah. Now they're into the Greek, and again, the Greek New Testament, or Greek Septuagint, which it's written like this. That's the symbol, 70, because supposedly there were 70 scribes translated it in down in Alexandria, Egypt. But this right here, the Septuagint, is quoted often in the New Testament. For example, the book of Hebrews. The quotes in the book of Hebrews, the New Testament book, are quotes from the Septuagint, not from the Hebrew Scriptures. You can kind of tell how they translate into the English language, or from the Greek to the English, of what translation they used. Nonetheless, there's some information. Then you've got Manasseh between 245 and 240. Then Onias II, who is called by Josephus a man with a little soul, or little soul. He is known as being very covetous, and is recorded as being limited in his intelligence. So much so, now this is important. Onias II, right here, this is an important time in Jewish history. They say he was limited in intelligence, that he was covetous. One thing he did not do and failed to do was, at this time, we're going to get into the Syrian wars here, if I hurry. And by this time, the Syrian wars have begun, and just a little heads up, we're heading here. Here's Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. This is Egypt, controlled by the Ptolemies. This is Syria, controlled by the Seleucid, or the Seleucid line, or Antiochus. Jerusalem. Onias II, at this time, Egypt controlled Judah. And he was supposed to be sending a yearly tribute of money down to Egypt. He failed to do that. So Ptolemy, the king, and there's a whole series of Ptolemies. It's like Herod. It's like a family name. There are several of them. He sends someone up to get the money, but in the process, a man finds out, you know, if we can make this work, I'll collect the taxes for you. And we end up having our first tax collector from Egypt collecting money from the Jews to pay the Ptolemy, or pay the king. And you can see this right here. He did not pay Ptolemy the Third. And the guy's name was, okay, Onias was the king. Onias was the priest. He's got a nephew through his brother, Tobias, named Joseph. And Joseph is the one who goes down and begins to develop the ideal of the tax collector. Very important in the New Testament. Matthew was a tax collector. It was a very, I guess you'd call it a scoundrel type of position. And you'd probably know this, but they'd have a certain amount of money they'd have to turn in. And to make a profit, you just charge people something extra to put in your pocket. And so if you ever needed a raise, you just charge people more. Ptolemy, he would ask for more money maybe each year, so you'd have to ask the people for more, and you'd want a raise. And so it became a very, very lucrative position, and they could end up buying and selling these tax collector positions. And that begins to take place in the days of Onias II. He's followed by Simeon II. During this time, the Pharisees who are resisting the Hellenization of the culture or the going over to the Greek, they're becoming the conservatives, and there's two different groups are forming now, the Pharisees and the conservative group, and the Sadducees, or the priests, who like the Hellenization. And we're going to see as we go through this, again, I'm oversimplifying this possibly, but it's a good way to begin understanding it, is you're going to have the, we're going to say conservative, and you don't need to think Republican or political like that, and you got the liberals over here, liberals. You don't have to think something else. But anyway, over here, the liberals, they were going to become Hellenized. And they saw the Grecian way of life as being the way of the future, say like socialism. And they began to see that this is the way we can make money. The priest who had the power saw this as a way to preserve their money, make more money, and the priest tended to be more liberal and wanted to Hellenize the culture. This is going to lead to a religious group called the Sadducees. I'm not sure if I'm going to spell this right. The Sadducees. They were the liberals. They came from the priests. They had a lot of the money. They liked the Greek culture. Over here on this side, people who said, absolutely not, because this included a compromise of the covenant of God. And so this group right here wanted to stay with the Hebrew way of life, the traditional way of life. They were willing to resist the priest and to stop the priest who had the power of the temple. There's only one way to stop the priest, or one main way, and that was to know the law. Oops, Lou. That was to know the law of Moses. It's like it'd be like a court case. The priest wanted to do this. Wait, we've got a rule written down in our Torah that says you can't do that. And so to know the law, you'd become a scribe. And it became a legal position, and they became lawyers. And the lawyers and the scribes committed to the law, not so much because they loved God, some of them did, but a lot of them because this was their power to resist the priest and the liberals. So you got the problem of the conservatives versus the liberals. The liberals were Grecian in culture, still Jews, going after the money and the power. These guys were the ones who held on to the traditions and resisted this movement, and they became known as the Pharisees. And they hated each other. If we keep going through this, there's times where the Sadducees, when they got in power, because now you're getting down to these the Hasmoneans or the Maccabean priest coming out of the Maccabean line, Alexander, Janus, and John Hyrcanus, and Aristobulus. These men are going to pick sides. You know, just like you may have a liberal president or a conservative president, depending, and they're going to pick their political party. And sometimes brothers are going to be opposite of each other. And they're going to end up even getting to the place where the Sadducees at one point were crucifying the Pharisees. I mean, they're Jews crucifying Jews because of their political stance. And this led into, even in the scriptures, the Sadducees were liberal in their interpretations. And you know this. Jesus in this last week was confronting them, and they were confronting Jesus. But they didn't believe in the resurrection from the dead. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in an afterlife. It was, you know, they're typical, in a sense, even today, the liberals don't believe, well, we all should follow God, but we don't believe anything. And they're free to define what they wanted. The Pharisees, of course, believed exactly like the scriptures that they thought they understood, believed in the resurrection of the dead. They believed in angels. You remember when Paul was on trial, he went down into Jerusalem, got arrested, and was brought before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a collection that would be like the Senate. They ruled the Jewish culture, Jerusalem and Judea. But they were made up of members of both the Sadducees and the Pharisees, or the liberals and the conservatives, or the scribes and the priests. And again, this doesn't necessarily mean if you were a Sadducee, you were a priest, and you had money, and you were liberal, but generally that always kind of went together. It didn't have to be that way. I suppose you could be a Pharisee and be a priest. But anyway, when Paul was called in front of the Sanhedrin, remember what he says? He says, why are you here? And he was going to lose the case, and so he says, you remember what he said? I stand before you today because of the testimony or something of the resurrection of the dead. And what happened right there, remember what happened? The Pharisees all of a sudden says, We see nothing wrong with this man. He just threw out one of the talking points. I don't know if Paul was really sincere in what he was saying. Obviously, he believed it, but he was just throwing a bone out. It's like, I believe in the resurrection from the dead. And the Pharisees are like, I think he's innocent. And the Sadducees says, absolutely not. His doctrine's off base. And it split them. Remember, they started arguing and fighting right there. But Paul used this to, you know, split the Sanhedrin to move him on to the next court case. But nonetheless, that's all being brought together right here during this time of Onias the Second. Simeon the Second, two parties were developing, the Greek and the cultures. And remember, Hellenization is like the lady, the Greek lady, Helen. It means Grecianizing your culture. It has nothing to do with, think of it as Helen, not hell. Because a lot of times you say the word Hellenization, it's like, oh yeah, we're against hell. It's like, well, that's nothing to do with it. It's about Helen in the Grecian culture. Then Onias the Third, or Onias the Third, a very good high priest. He's going to be arrested by Antiochus Epiphanes, because what's going to happen is his brother, who was Joshua, is going to take the name. Onias the Third is the high priest. He is of this side over here, though. He's a conservative at this time, trying to stay with the law. His brother Joshua falls over here on this side. And as Onias the Third, and he is mentioned, I believe, Onias the Third is mentioned in the book of Daniel. Hopefully we can see it here tonight. Onias the Third is resisting this movement here. Antiochus Epiphanes wants to get the money out of the temple that the tax collectors are keeping in the temple. And Joshua goes up to pay a tribute, some kind of a payment to Antiochus Epiphanes up north. And when he gets there, he says, hey, you know, I've got an idea. You need more money, Antiochus. And Antiochus, now watch. This is getting real close to eschatology. Because if Antiochus is a type of the Antichrist, which I think he is, and you can see this when you get to the book of Daniel, then this high priest right here could be a type of the false prophet that comes alongside the first and second beast of Revelation 13. Just keep that in mind. But anyway, he goes up and says, hey, you know, you need to get access into the temple. And Antiochus says, indeed, there's a lot of money there. And Joshua says, I tell you what, if you'll give me the high priest position instead of my brother Onias, I'll help you. So he pays a certain amount of money extra and comes back with a military that says, Onias, you're under arrest. And they take Onias off the priesthood and take him up into Syria. And Joshua changes his name from that old Hebrew name and changes his name to Jason, which is a good Greek name. And there's we got him right here. And he's now working for Antiochus Epiphanes, which works pretty good for a while until he sends his representative up to bring in his tribute or taxation to Antiochus Epiphanes. He sends his one of his buddies, Menelaus, from the tribe of Benjamin, who brings the money up to Antiochus Epiphanes and says, how much is Jason paying you for the priesthood? Antiochus says, well, he's paying me this much. Menelaus says, I'll pay you twice as much for this position. Oh, well, then you're the high priest. So Menelaus returns with a military, and Jason is removed from the position. And now Menelaus, a man from the tribe of Benjamin, has just broken the line of the priest. Here's brother against brother, but now you got a tribe of Benjamin knocking off Jason. And now we're into the Maccabean period of the Maccabean revolt. And that's far enough for tonight. There's some other things you can read right on there that we'll get into probably next week. Okay, that's a little bit about the priest. I know that's kind of boring if you look at it, but at the same time, you can feel, I think, you can feel the details and the excitement that's happening there. At least I do. So here we go. Now, the yellow sheet. You know, as if it's not enough, I make a book, give you a book, and they start handing out notes. I mean, what's wrong with this? You can see that list of priests that I just gave you. I think it's in your books on page 154. But it starts with Jaddua and kind of runs down to Onias the Third. And I just wanted to show you this, you know, this connection right here. So we are on now, please. We are on page 148 of our textbooks. And if you notice right here on page 1, you're going to have three battles. A and B are the first battle that Alexander meets with the Persians. Then you're going to have the third battle of Issus, which is map C. And this is not for you to memorize or anything, just to let you know that we've got a lot of details and kind of a little bit of an image. And then D and E are his last battle with the Persians when he faces Darius for the third time. So here we go. We're on page 148. The best way to do this is I think, is just read through this information, kind of try and tell it in story form. you're going to have to concentrate and kind of stay with me on this because it's great material, but we're covering a lot of stuff. So here we go. Year is 367. So as we look down here on our chart, 367 falls right in here, Jaddua's reign. So now we're not that far from the Old Testament. In fact, we're still in. Jaddua is mentioned at the in Nehemiah chapter, I think it's 12. So these priests come right down here. We're right in this time period. We're going to march right on through here. But anyway, in 367, 366, 365, 15-year-old Philip, son of the Macedonian king, is taken hostage to Thebes. We're over now. And let's get a new map here. And I'm pretty good at drawing the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea and the Sea of Galilee. That's pretty good. But you start getting over there in Greece and the Aegean Sea and all that, it's kind of sloppy. So let's see if we can do this. Here's the northern border of Africa. Okay, that's already bad. Coming up here, Mediterranean coast. Here's Asia Minor coming up over here. And here we go. Here's Greece. I think it comes in something like this. How's that? Looks just like, well, looks like it did last time. Okay, up in here, we got Thebes and this is Macedonia. Now understand this, Macedonia and Greece, if we can say it that way, they're two countries. They're not necessarily the same. Alexander's going to unite them, and he's going to move this way. Way over here is Persia. You know, we got Babylon, we got Susa, we got Persepolis. Persepolis is real important because that's where Alexander's going to end up. Alexander's going to go from here, and he's going to go off the wall right here. I mean, by the time he gets done, he comes back to Babylon. It's an amazing story. One of the most amazing stories, I think, in history is what's about to take place with Alexander. And what's even more amazing about it is Daniel prophesied about it. Daniel says this is what's going to take place. Alexander, you can just see him on a fast track, just following God's plan. One of the things Alexander does, if you want to talk about God controlling history, is one, he's going to bring the Greek language. He's going to go through this, and there's all different languages, and the Persians have tried to unite it, the Babylonians have tried to unite it, but Alexander's going to march through this and bring the Greek language. He's going to bring the Greek culture. He's going to Hellenize every place he goes. Hellenize, and he's going to bring the Greek culture. He's going to establish some form of peace and unity as far as cultures, which the Romans are going to pick up and add to this. The Romans will add to this the road system and, again, the Roman peace of just, you know, the forced peace, which is going to create a world that Paul describes in Galatians as in the fullness of time, God sent his son. You know, God could have sent his son at a variety of times, but he's going to send it at a time where once the gospel comes out of Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, you know, there's a map, we'll get to it in the book, and you've seen other places. On the day of Pentecost, there's Jews from every country that were there that had come out of the dispersion and had come back to worship, and they went back to their home countries, including all the way over to... I'm messing up my map with the book of Acts chapter 2. And, you know, they took it all over, and they came out of Jerusalem with the message of the gospel into a culture that had a road system. Paul used the road system. It had peace. It had a common language and somewhat of a common culture so that they could all kind of work together. I got peace written twice. And the gospel took off like wildfire so that by 300, 325, the whole Roman world just converts to Christianity. Of course, Constantine had something to do with it. But a lot of that, God is setting the stage for all of this with these events. So if you want to see God working in this, I think it's pretty easy. Again, looking at the big picture. Okay, here we go. We're over in Greece, Macedonia. The guy's name is Philip, and they found Philip's tomb. Philip's tomb has been found, Philip of Macedonia. That's Alexander's father. He's in Thebes in Greece. He learns military science. He learns the Greek passion to overthrow the Persians. Because realize, right here, the Persians have come all the way over here, and they've crossed the border a couple of times, or crossed the Aegean Sea a couple of times, and we've had the Battle of Marathon, you know, Xerxes battles, Artaxerxes. So the Greeks hate the Persians. Some of the Greeks have even settled over here in a sense of colonies, trying to infiltrate over here. So there are some Greek colonies over here. So when Alexander comes, these Greek colonies are going to say, you know, you're a deliverer. Alexander's going to be seen as a deliverer more than anything. Well, anyway, Philip learns about this and brings it back to Macedonia. 359, Philip becomes co-regent with his father in Macedonia and demonstrates the ability as a general and in diplomacy. Again, remember, Macedonia is a small country right here, along with Greece and other things, countries around it. 356, Philip becomes the king of Macedonia in 356. So over here in our little diagram, 356, Jaddua is still the high priest. He turns Macedonian military into a tool of expansion by taking Greek cities and the gold and silver mines of Philippi. You know, Paul's going to go up here to Philippi, right about it here. There's gold mines there. Philip conquers that, and that's going to finance his military efforts. He's going to start conquering Greece. He's going to develop, I don't know if we got it written down here, yes. He reorganized the Macedonian army and begins to use the phalanx. And the phalanx is a group of soldiers that march fairly close together, but with these long spears, and they would drill. He began to drill his soldiers. Now, what's going to happen? There's so many things to talk about. I got to get moving. The Persians were just a massive army, just huge numbers of people that they'd conquered and brought into their service. The Macedonians are training themselves as far as a skill, and they're going to develop this phalanx of where this unit would march and move in these long spears, and no one can get to them, and it's a great military technique that Alexander's going to use. But anyway, it describes it here. Heavily armored infantry troops in tight ranks of 8 to 12 rows that carry long spears and overlapping shields. It's like a turtle moving with points coming out of it. Goes on, Alexander was born in 356. So no sooner is Alexander going to be born historically, and next thing we know, in a matter of 32 years, he's dead. In 32 years, Alexander's going to be dead. In 337, Philip announces his decision to his Greek confederacy that he is going to invade Persia. He's already come down here and kind of tried to unite these countries, or unite Greece and conquer it. He said, we're going to go get Persia. Big ideas Philip has. Philip sends 10,000 troops in 336 across the Aegean Sea to Troy. Troy is right here. Troas in your New Testament maps. He sends them over here to Troy, and he's beginning his invasion, kind of his preliminary movement into Persian territory. In the summer of 336, Philip is assassinated at his daughter's wedding when an attendant steps forward and stabs him. So Philip is now dead. Alexander is 20 years old. Now just imagine a 20-year-old kid right now. Just in your mind, pick out some 20-year-old kid. Again, not to make fun of him, but just imagine a 20-year-old kid. His father was the king of Macedonia and had united Greece by attacking them and brought them into his control and was beginning his invasion of Persia. Somebody didn't like the idea of invading Persia. They thought it was a bad idea. He's assassinated. The unity that they had here, because Philip is going to break down. And you've now got Alexander, who is a 20-year-old kid who is heir to the throne just because his dad was the king. Now, Alexander, a little bit about Alexander. He was sent, because his dad learned about Greek culture, he sent Alexander down to Greece to be trained. He was trained by, guess who? Aristotle was his elementary teacher. And he had the Iliad memorized at the age of 13. So Aristotle is not just teaching him, information. He's teaching him how to think. He's teaching him how to categorize things, how to handle information, to put it in different groups and solve problems. Aristotle would be a fairly good elementary teacher, I would assume. At 18, he was the Macedonian's ambassador to Athens before his father died. His mother was Olympus. These are Greeks, so she was a white skin, but she had red hair, they say. And she taught him some real good doctrine. His doctrine that he was taught was that she was an ancestor of Achilles, and that his father Philip came through the line of Hercules. And so he had no doubt in his mind that he was half God through Achilles and Hercules. And he kind of fought that way. That's how he would kind of go to battle. And again, if you want to get superstitious about this, it almost looks like something was going on here. Because he just was, I think God's plan was with him. We'd go back to the scriptures. But the thing that Alexander does is real amazing, very amazing. Well, anyway, when Philip dies, Thebes then says, well, we're done with this. And Thebes rebels against the young 20-year-old Macedonian king who thinks he's going to continue his father's little kingdom here, ruling Greece. So Thebes rebels, and Alexander then takes his troops and marches down and sends 30,000 of its people into slavery. And the rest of Greece then decides, okay, I think we can work with this kid. And so now Alexander is establishing his position here in Macedonian Greece. At the age of 22, Alexander leaves Pella. Now you've got a map right there, a fairly rough map. You're going to go online and find better maps. But on page 148, you've got a map of Alexander's battles from the age of 20 up until he was 33 or so when he dies. And you see where Pella's at. It's not in Iowa. Pella's right there in Macedonia. He's going to march into Philippi. He's going to cross the Hellespont right there and have his first encounter with the Persians at the Granicus River. And he leaves with 30,000 foot soldiers, not a large army, 5,000 cavalry. He himself has a group called the Champions that are his bodyguard. He rides his horse, is called Brucipolis, rides it through the next 10, 12 years. He rides them all the way through. He crosses over to sails for Troy. And now what takes place right there, if you look at, I'm not going to go through the battle play by play, but you can look at what happens right here. You've got him approaching the Granicus River there. And his generals said that, well, because there's such a larger number of Persian troops on the other side, Alexander, what we need to do is we probably better wait and maybe get organized and maybe even attack at night, a sneak attack at night, like they wouldn't be expecting that. You're just across the river from each other. Alexander says, no, let's do it now, and leads the charge across the Granicus River, and his troops are following him, and the Persians were thinking that the guy was going to fight like some kind of intelligent type of warfare, like a sneak attack at night or some kind of structure, but he just kind of rides up there, looks and says, what are we waiting for? And the Persians, what is he doing? He's attacking. And they're like, we're not even ready. And they scattered. And that was his first encounter. You kind of see the battle right there, how it's drawn up, how he attacks, just marches across the river, leads the charge, and the Persians scatter. And that's going to set the stage for one of his later battles. Now, I'm rushing through this. If you really care about this, go read military history and stuff. There's a lot more to it. But it kind of gives you a flavor of what's happening here. 333, you can follow your map now. He comes down that coast from Troy. Of course, I mentioned right here, these are all Grecian settlements. And so these people aren't resisting him. They're opening their gates for him. He comes across here, comes back up through Asia Minor, goes through Gordium. There's a knot there, the Gordium knot, that whoever... theoretic or story goes, whoever could untie this knot would be the king of the world. It's connected to two posts. It's physically impossible. Alexander walks up with a sword, just cuts it in half, and says, how's that? Okay, that'll work. And so the sign was that he's going to do that. He comes down to the Cilician gates right there, and there's a very narrow passageway where two camels couldn't get through, and very easy to guard to get into the Persian territory even deeper. And he goes through it with no problem, just rushes through that, and they allowed him to come. And he's going to meet now at Issus in 333 at the Battle of Issus. And you got, again, a little map there. And it takes something like this. Pass through the Cilician gates at night. In the fall, Alexander meets the Persian king, Darius III, the last of the Persian kings, for the first time himself, meeting the king face-to-face in battle. The Greeks outmaneuvered the Persians. Once again, Philip's training. Alexander continued that training. Alexander the Champion, his elite cavalry, charged and collapsed the Persian front line. You can see him getting through on that right there. You see the big blue arrow. That's Alexander and the Champions. He's leading the charge, collapses the front line. Now he's into the interior of their battle line. Darius flees. Alexander pursues the Persian king and doesn't catch him, but spends the night in the Persian king's royal tent, which would be a very elaborate tent. And things are deteriorating very quickly for the Persians. That was the second encounter. We're in 333. Page number 332, turn the page. Now that's right over here at Issus. He comes down now, comes down the Mediterranean coast. He's heading this way, heading down towards Egypt. And you can read some details here. It goes through the mountains of Lebanon, between the mountains of Lebanon and the Mediterranean Sea, down the coastal plain. Cities are opening themselves up to him. Comes to the city of Tyre. Now, I'm going to have you go to your Bibles, please. Go to the book of Ezekiel. We've referred to this before, but I kind of want to look at it in a little more detail tonight. Ezekiel chapter 26. Ezekiel 26. And this right here, Ezekiel 26, talks about Tyre, which is an island city. There's a coastal city also on the coast, but half a mile off the coast is an island, and it's the city of Tyre. It's the Phoenicians. They're great trading people. They sailed down. They started Carthage. They sailed out of the Mediterranean Sea into the Atlantic Ocean. There's clear evidence that the Phoenicians had reached North America. There's Greek inscriptions. There's Roman Latin inscriptions that have been found in Northern America. That's clearly, these people were traveling around the world, including down around Africa. But nonetheless, they're great seafaring people. Alexander comes down here, and they had gone through, and we mentioned this when we talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had fought these people for some 14 years and had never taken the city, never could take the city. In fact, here we go, in chapter 26 of Ezekiel, verse 7. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. From the north I'm going to bring against Tyre Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots, with horsemen and a great army. Okay? And he did. Now, whenever you read that in the Bible, and God says, I'm going to bring Nebuchadnezzar against Jerusalem, Jerusalem's going to fall. Or I'm going to bring Nebuchadnezzar against Egypt, Egypt is going to fall. But Nebuchadnezzar came against Tyre, and it never fell. Nebuchadnezzar spent 14 years there, and nothing happened. He didn't win. But yet the verse continues. It says, he, in verse 8, will ravage your settlements on the mainland with the sword. Okay, that'd be these right here, the coastal cities of Tyre, or area settlements. He will set up siege works against you and build ramp up to your walls and raise his shields against you. He will direct his blows and his battering rams against your walls and demolish your towers with his weapons. His horse will be so many. And now they begin talking about destroying the entire city and dragging it off into the sea. Nebuchadnezzar never did that. Well, here's the storyline. Alexander got here. He sends ambassadors over, which he was customary, would send Greek ambassadors, and the city would just, and he had success, just open the gates and allow Alexander in. And they'd sign some kind of a treaty that they would learn the Greek language, that they'd cooperate, that they'd no longer be faithful to the Persians, but would give their tribute to Alexander, and he would just keep marching. Well, Tyre killed the ambassadors and threw them over the wall into the sea. Well, Alexander decided, I've got to do something about this. So if you turn your page right here, on page 2 of the yellow sheet, Alexander is going to now take, he's going to take about 7 months. And you can see Tyre is an island city. You can see the island city there. And he's going to build a 200-foot wide road out to the island, half a mile long. And you can see in the bottom picture, Jay there, you can see him building out. You see the siege works right there leading the charge. And the army laid down their weapons for 7 months, and they became a construction crew. And they built a road out to the island of Tyre. And once they got the road built, they says, okay, now we know how to fight. We don't know how to fight in the sea. We don't know how to negotiate with these people, but we'll just build a road and we'll destroy their city. And you can read on in Ezekiel, if you don't mind, in verse 9, he'll direct his blows of his battering rams against your walls and demolish your towers with his weapons. His horses will be so many they'll cover you with dust. Your walls will tremble at the noise of his war horses, wagons, and chariots when he enters your gates as men enter a city whose walls have been broken through. The hooves of his horses will trample all your streets. He will kill your people and your sword with the sword, and your strong pillars will fall to the ground. Now, if you notice right there, as we read on here, I've got a picture J or H right there. You can see the pillars of the city in the water there. They've been drug off, just scraped off. And that's what goes on and says, verse 13, I'll put an end to your noisy songs. There it is, verse 14. I'll make you a bare rock, and you'll become a place to spread fish nets. You will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken, declares the sovereign Lord. And he basically scraped the city off into the sea, and there's nothing left of it. It's just today, even, there's fishing nets, except look at picture I. I mean, the people fish out there, and there's fishing nets just stretched out on the rocks as they're waiting for them to dry. Exactly what God said. But look at picture I. That is a modern satellite picture of Tyre. You can see there to the left what the island of Tyre, but notice the 200-foot roadway that Alexander built has filled in with silt, and it's actually part of the mainland now. So Alexander built a road, and over the years it's just filled in, and now Tyre is part of the mainland. Just kind of amazing that took place. And I just thought that's a fun story that you can see right there. Well, nonetheless, that takes place there in the year 323, and he marches on. He continues down after 7 months in Tyre. He continues going south here. He comes to Gaza. Gaza refuses to open its gates. He destroys Gaza and continues on into Egypt. Comes to Memphis. They welcome him. Egypt, of course, had been conquered by the Persians and Artaxerxes. They didn't want anything to do with him, so they're glad he's there to get rid of the Persians. He then starts a city. Some of his soldiers have been fighting for a couple years now, and he leaves some of his soldiers behind to populate a city called Alexandria. And Alexandria is going to play big in history, both in Jewish history. Philo, one of the great Jewish writers, comes from Alexandria. He developed a whole line of teaching, allegorical teaching. We're going to get into that when we get into church history in Alexandria. Also, it became a very heavy populated Jewish community, which means this. When Jesus was taken to Egypt by his father Joseph and Mary, when Herod was trying to kill him, that probably was Alexander. We don't know. He just went to Egypt. But the common thought would be that he went to Alexandria. That is a heavy Jewish community there in Alexandria. Alexandria is going to become the home of guys like Origen in church history, and it's going to have a great library. But nonetheless, that was started at this time, Alexandria. It's going to be like one of, I don't know, 13 or something towns, cities that Alexander is going to establish and call, guess what? Alexandria. So, I mean, there's Alexandria is all across. It's like we never started to see it. What's a good name? I think we should call this town Alexandria. Okay, and they did. Well, he then goes off into the desert to an oasis out there called Ammon to meet with the goat god and get an oracle. No one knows what was told him. He then turns and comes back, and as he approaches Jerusalem, now you've got your story there about the high priest Jaddua that I'm going to read to you. Number one underneath there, it's where it says Jaddua the high priest. Right here we got his name. We are right here in history. Jaddua begins to think as he's watching this. Jaddua is in Jerusalem along with the Jews, and they're watching this. He can see on the coastal plains, you can see the army march by. You can see read about it in the papers. It's all in the news. Alexander is coming, and the Persians can't stop him. He's already defeated the Persian army, Darius, twice. Well, so they're starting to think, you know what? This sounds a lot like what Daniel's talking about. Now imagine watching prophecy develop and then getting to meet one of the actors in your prophecy. And Jaddua does this very thing. Number two, as Alexander approached Jerusalem, Jaddua did not lead Jerusalem to resist him, like, you know, in an army. Again, the priest could. The priest could have access to a military in these days. Instead, he put on his high priestly garments, took the scriptures in his hands, opened the gates, and went out to meet Alexandra. So the high priest has all of his garments on, and he's accompanied not by an army, but with the priesthood, dressed in their white linen. And so as Alexander's army is approaching Jerusalem, Jaddua goes out as the high priest dressed with a white army, and they have no weapons. They're just coming out to meet him. Well, they could have been walking into a slaughter. This is Alexander the Great, who is just marching through cities. But Alexander got off his horse, hurried over to Jaddua, and bowed down in front of him. One of Alexander's generals says, "What are you doing?" I mean, here's Alexander bowing in front of a high priest of the Jews from Jerusalem. Alexander said that he had seen Jaddua in a vision and that Jaddua was a representative of heaven. Alexander told Jaddua that he had to say, whatever he had to say would be of great advantage to Alexander. He said, "I know what you are going to say is something that's important." Now, this is the way it's recorded in the Maccabees or in Josephus and writings like that. Jaddua then opened up the scroll of Daniel and read from the prophecy about Alexander. Alexander then promised Jerusalem, and Alexander considered prophecies about himself. He promised Jerusalem would never be touched nor its temple polluted. He entered Jerusalem, worshipped as a Gentile at the temple, and then gave them gifts and blessed them and says, "You're going to be taken care of," and moved on. He then goes up to Samaria. They try to pull something similar, and he destroyed them. And he takes his troops then back up to Tyre. Now he's gone all the way through here. Comes up to Tyre and rests his troops right here. And I've got to stop drawing now because we're going to be going off the map right here. So you can see going back on page 148, kind of where he's at, and now he's going to be heading over to his next battle, Gaugamela in 331. So they're going to be going across this plain. All right, let's go ahead and do this, if you don't mind. Here's our Mediterranean. There's something more familiar. There we go, Dead Sea, Jordan River. He's at Tyre. Here's your rivers, Persian Gulf. Darius knows he's coming. I didn't tell you this. After his last battle up here with Darius, Darius offered him, I think I skipped the point there, he offered him several things. Where's that list at? Oh, yeah, there it is, top of page 332. He offers, number one, at the Battle of Issus right here, Darius realizes he's beat, and his soldiers are retreating, and that he's going to have to face Alexander sooner or later. And before Alexander gets into his home territory, he says, "I will give you this. I'll give you one-third of my kingdom. I'll give you my daughter in marriage," meaning you can marry into the royal line. And then the money was $300 million in gold. He offered him that. And Alexander, again, talked to his generals about it. And they go, "Well, it's not a bad offer for a 25-year-old kid. He goes, "I'd rather have the whole thing." So he rejected it and is going to continue coming. So now we are over on page, where are we at? 151 at the top. So Darius now knows he's coming. He burns this entire area, wherever their battle they're coming in. He burns it to the ground. So Alexander's going to have to march through scorched ground, no resources, no food. And they're going to meet there at Gaugamela. And you can see that's over in here somewhere. You can see on the map exactly. And in this case right here, Alexander, both at when he crossed the Hellespont and at Issus, had attacked suddenly, right away. And so the Persians are anticipating an attack very similar, that he's just going to rush across and take them. So night comes, they stay up all night long, and Alexander tells his troops, we're going to attack in the morning, so go to sleep. So Alexander's troops sleep all night. The Persian troops are up all night on guard waiting for Alexander to come, which he never does. And then some early in the morning, when they're all tired, Alexander then begins the attack, and I think I laid my paper down already. But you can see on the attack, there's two pictures right here, and the same thing right there is they got the battle lines drawn up there. It's D and E, and Alexander leads the attack again, breaks through the line. And what happens here, the crucial thing that happens here is the line, we're going to have, this is, let's just say, the Greek line facing the Persians. The Persians bring out their chariots. That's why they burnt this ground, so they could use their chariots against Alexander. What he ends up doing is the chariots attack, and Alexander allows this to break, and the chariots just get in the middle of his men. And there's nowhere for them to go. They can't turn them or steer. They just kind of, like a traffic jam right here, and the Greeks just start pulling the chariot drivers off on the ground and killing them, just rout the army. And again, they're running. Their whole plan was destroyed again. And again, Alexander showing that he had some kind of, again, strategy and a good strategist. He ends up coming down to Persepolis. He stops in Babylon, rests there for a month in Babylon. Let's do it this way. Comes down to Babylon's over here. Okay, sorry. Comes to Babylon. While he gets there in Babylon, he has his leaders, his generals, marry Persian women. They wear Persian clothes. And he takes over this area right here and appoints Persian leaders for the positions. They thought they're going to be conquered. Instead, he just kind of morphs into them, kind of like the Persians did with Daniel. And the Persians now say, well, this is a great guy. He spends a month or so there, goes to Persepolis, and in retaliation, if you remember, Athens had been burnt in 480 by Xerxes. In retaliation for this, because his dad had taught him this, Aristotle had taught him to hate the Persians, he burns the city of Persepolis to the ground. It's a fantastic city, just torched it in one night, destroys the city. We're in 330. Alexander leaves in the spring to try and catch up with Darius, to capture him, but by the time he catches up with him, traveling 36 miles a day, Darius is already been assassinated by one of his generals. Alexander then continues here, going off into the east until his troops are just say, when are we going to quit? Alexander wanted to find the end of the world. He thought he could see the end of the world if he just kept marching east. He just kept getting longer and longer. Finally, they go through the mountains. They end up coming down through India and through a series of events. They've gotten sick. They've had problems, run out of food. They have several battles they fight. Alexander gets shot with an arrow one time going up over a wall. And they end up coming back through the desert. Some of his men get on ships and sail up to the Persian coast or Persian Gulf. He himself leads his troops through the desert back to Babylon. And after we are now in the year 323, right there at the bottom of page 151, his wounds, the hardships, heavy drinking, on June 11th of 323, at the age of 32, Alexander is struck with a fever. He's immobilized. His troops march by him one more time. He makes eye contact with each of them as they march by, and Alexander dies there in 323. He's got a son, a baby son named Hercules, who's instantly killed so that it doesn't take over. The generals now want his empire, and Alexander II is killed in 310 at the age of 13. And now you've got a map on page 151, and we introduce you to the generals of that's going to now set up the next phase of history for the Jews. The generals are going to now fight for, or they divide it up, but here's how it ends up. One of the generals, Lysimachus, takes Thrace and Macedonia in that area. Thrace. Cassander and Antipater take Macedonia and Greece. A guy named Antigonus takes Syria. He's going to be there for a while, but Seleucus is going to come up and take that. Seleucus takes Babylon, and Ptolemy takes Egypt. The main ones you want to remember are going to be Lysimachus, Cassander, Antigonus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And out of them, the ones you're going to want to remember is Seleucus and Ptolemy. Now turn the page. Are you okay? Okay. What time is it getting to be?
Seven.
You want some more coins to look at? I got some more coins. Yes, sir. Right. It seems like it's Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know. And the things that actually take place, Nebuchadnezzar never accomplished. And again, I don't know the Hebrew exactly. I just know it says Nebuchadnezzar and then it says he. Now, what that word is, if it's actually there, if it's just a pickup from the other sentence, I'm not sure. I just know that Alexander, as you go through this, you remember the statue. You've got Nebuchadnezzar, and then following him was Cyrus, and then the next was Alexander. You know, they're called the Babylonians, or they're called the Persians, or they're called the Greeks, but Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonians. Cyrus was the Persians. Alexander was the Greeks. And they all are kind of in this line of the power that God has anointed as far as who is the Gentile leaders of the time of the Gentiles. So in a sense, if you look at it that way, when you crunch them all together, Nebuchadnezzar is Cyrus, and Cyrus is Alexander, the leader of this head, this statue that is the leaders of the age of the Gentiles. That's the only thing I can think of is that Nebuchadnezzar and Alexander are both in prophecy holding the position of the king of the world that God has given to Nebuchadnezzar. Then he gave it to Cyrus, and now he's clearly given it to Alexander. So that's the only connection I can make there. Because those prophecies weren't fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar. Unless you want to take all those prophecies and just leave them all on the coast, on everything, all that took place on the cities on the coast, and never does address the island city of Tyre, maybe that's not even talking about the island city of Tyre. It's just talking about Nebuchadnezzar's work on the coastal plain there. But right, it doesn't say Alexander there. Is that? I mean, there's. It's a great story. Yeah. But is that what Ezekiel's talking about? Right. Then you really need to go back and look at how much did Nebuchadnezzar even do. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy Tyre. I know he did not finish off the city of Tyre. And that story is giving the account that he's finishing off the city. Drag it into the sea. He fought them for 14 years, but when he got done, they're still there. So he never conquered Tyre. So that's the only thing I can say is that it's that power base that shifted from Nebuchadnezzar to Cyrus to Alexander. Yeah, it's not as clear as you get in Daniel with the goat and the ram and the leopard, you know, with the wings and stuff. Right, more than just the Babylonians. Yep. Yeah, I understand that question, and that's the best I can do to defend that. I like the story, so. But yeah, I don't want to be misleading in just because I like the story. Okay, 301, are you guys still with me here? We got some more. I'd like to get to pay. What time is it? You didn't tell me what time it was. It's almost 8 o'clock? Oh, okay. Well, anyway, 301. What you're looking at now is we've got, here we go. Here's our map. Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea, Egypt. We've got the battle. First battle is going to take place is Ipsus. You can see that on, you got to go back to page 151 where they were divided it up. And that's up here in Asia Minor. And in this battle right here, you're going to have the generals now want, they work together as often as they have to, but they ultimately, secretly, they all want to be the next Alexander. And so in this battle right here, Antigonus is going to try to rebuild the empire, and he's now decided, I'll take it, and he's going to face the other generals. Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander are all going to fight here against Antigonus. You can read the details there. Antigonus' cavalry is routed Seleucus' cavalry. We go through the battle scene right there. But basically what ends up happening is that when they get done with this, Seleucid controls Babylon, Syria, and Eastern Asia, and forms a city, which we know of, is Antioch. So this becomes Seleucid's territory up here in the north. Coming from Babylon, coming across the Asia Minor, Seleucid controls this. Two of the guys go further west. And he's going to end up, Ptolemy is going to come down here and is going to take this. And these guys are going to have now a series of war. If you look there on that map, and this is going to take several hundred years. You've got the kings of the south there in the Mediterranean Sea. You just got a box of them. And they're going to go through. They're all called Ptolemy until you get down to Cleopatra. Ptolemy the first, Ptolemy the second. They've all got names like Soter, which means savior. Ptolemy the second, Philadelphus, means lover of his brother. You go down and you got on the other side with the kings of the north, you've got the Seleucids. Seleucid the first, and they're going to go back and forth between Seleucus and Antiochus. And again, they've got the first, second. That gets a little more confusing. But they're going to continue to interact all the way through until you get down to Antiochus Epiphanes. And at that time, the Romans are making a real strong approach, and we're going to be dealing with the Romans. And now we're getting in 274, we're going to have beginning this the Syrian Wars. We're going to have six of the Syrian Wars. I think we should probably stop and do that next time. Let me do this, and we'll end with this if this even works, makes sense. Go to Daniel chapter 11. And if you want to get your thinking hats on here, as far as, you know, you're looking at that verse in Ezekiel, this now is a section of verses that, for the liberal mind, destroys the credibility of Daniel as being an authentic work of Daniel, because there is so much prophecy fulfilled here that they say this is impossible. Clearly, somebody wrote this after it took place. And what I want you to do is on page 152, you can kind of see those kings. I wanted to go through those Syrian wars first and then come back and read this, but we're going to do it the other way around. We'll pick up the Syrian wars next time. But as you look at those kings right there, Ptolemy the first, Ptolemy the second, Seleucid the first, Antiochus the first, I'm going to read through this beginning in Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, and take you up through maybe verse 21, and then we'll quit. I'm just going to try and read it quickly and tell you which kings we're talking about, because it does match his, like reading a newspaper as far as events. Here we go, chapter 11, verse 2. The angel tells Daniel, "Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and these three more kings would be Cambyses, Smyrna, and Darius. Then a fourth, and that would be Xerxes, who will be far richer than all the others, and he will, when he has gained power by his wealth, he'll stir everyone up against the kingdom of Greece." And remember, Xerxes did that, goes to war, and his son Artaxerxes continues it. Then, that's enough about that. The point there was, we've now got a conflict with Persia and Greece. That's what the angel's talking about. Xerxes stirs everybody up. Then we finish up all the line of the kings of the Persians, coming up to the time of Darius, the third, the last one. Verse 3, "Then a mighty king will appear." And again, mighty king is another translation, would be hero king will appear. And that is Alexander, if you allow me to interpret it that way, "who will rule with great power and do as he pleases." And if you look at that march across the world that he did there, he did pretty much what he pleased. I mean, including building a bridge out to Tyre, whatever I want to do, I will do it. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. Now again, four winds of heaven, I think, means in every direction, just scattered. But it is interesting that four basic generals, Lysimachus, Cassanders, Ptolemy, and Seleucid, divide his empire up. It will not go to his descendants, Hercules or Alexander, because they're killed by the generals, nor will it have the power he exercised. So what's about to come out of this phase of the kingdom, remember, the head of gold gives way to the breast of silver, gives way to the waist of bronze. Alexander is that waste of bronze, but what he began, it's never going to reach that pinnacle of power. It's going to continue to deteriorate into the iron legs. It'll never reach that power because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. And now we begin a series right here. The king of the south will become strong, and that would be Ptolemy, the first Ptolemy listed right there, will become strong. But one of his commanders, And that would be solution, the first mentioned over there on the other side, because solution was serving as a general under Ptolemy in that first battle at Issus, okay, will become even stronger than he, and he will rule his own kingdom with great power. So that establishes now the king of the north, which would be Seleucid, who was a general under Ptolemy during the battle up here, but now he's going to have his own kingdom, and Ptolemy and Seleucid now are in position. And he will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south, her name is Bernice, will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. Now we're around 253. And so what happens, the king of the north, Seleucid, is going to set aside his Syrian wife and take this Egyptian wife. Now remember, when we talk about Ptolemy and Egypt, we're not talking about Egyptians. They're Greeks, correct? Ptolemy's a Greek general. Cleopatra is going to come out of here. Cleopatra is not an Egyptian. She's a Greek. But we'll still call them Egyptians here, right here. So Bernice, the daughter of the king of the south, verse 6. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she'll not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In other words, what ends up happening is she gets her husband is killed by his Syrian wife. Okay, Seleucid has a Syrian wife. Bernice comes up from Egypt. Is this boring or what? Okay, I feel it's boring. She comes up from it feels like a soap opera that you can't tell, right? She comes up and he sets aside his Syrian wife and he has a son with the Egyptian wife. But the Syrian wife poisons her husband, the king, and wants her son to become the king. And so here we go. So you got two wives. They both have a son, and now they both want them to have the throne of the Seleucid Empire. In those days, she'll be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supports her, Ptolemy from the south. The year is 246 now. One from her family, and that would be her brother, Ptolemy III. And you can follow this line as we're marching through here. Ptolemy III will rise to take her place. He will attack the force of the king of the north and enter his fortress, and he will fight against them and be victorious. Actually, they move in and actually camps out in Antioch, takes over the northern part. So now, this is the height of the Ptolemy's kingdom, the king of the south. He controls Egypt, Judah, and now Seleucid territory up here in Syria, and that's their height right here. And this is we're in the second Syrian war. Oh, I got to read fast. It says he'll also seize their gods with their metal images and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. Takes all the plunder and just plunders the northern kingdom. Now, why is this interesting? Why is this being told in Scripture? This is Judah right here. This is the people of God that have come back from captivity. But Egypt is fighting with Syria. These are Greeks fighting over this territory. The Greeks come from over here. They came over, and God just kind of moved these people in. And the thing is, all these battles going back and forth, they always march right through Judah. This is like the war zone, back and forth, that this is going through these years. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, and now we are in the fourth Syrian war. He'll retreat to his own country. His sons will be prepared for war and assemble a great army. This would be Antiochus III and his brother Seleucid, and that's one of the small coin I passed around. That was minted at that time, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress, coming down into Egypt. Then the king of the south, Ptolemy V, will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, that's Antiochus III, the Omega the Great, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated, and that's defeated at Gaza, right? Here's where they're defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant because just a little bit later, Antiochus is going to defeat him up here north of the Sea of Galilee. So he wins one battle, but he's quickly defeated. For the king of the north will muster another army, Antiochus III, larger than the first. Now this Antiochus III is the father of Antiochus IV, and he's going to become Antiochus Epiphanes. That is going to cause all of the problems with the Jews, that is kind of a forerunner of the Antichrist. Verse 14, in those times many will arise against the king of the south, or Ptolemy III. Down here in Egypt, there's unrest. The kingdom has reached its height, or this kingdom down here has reached its height. It's now declining. There's civil unrest down here in Egypt. Also, Rome is getting involved. Rome is now, it was a city, then it became a little country. Now it's crossed over to Carthage. It's now found out that Egypt has grain. And the Roman grain is coming out of Egypt. And as there's chaos is setting into the kingdom of the Ptolemy, Rome comes down and tells the Seleucids, leave them alone. Because if there's continues here, they're going to lose their grain supply. They're going to lose their military. And it says, the violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. There's some Jewish revolts at that time. Verse 15, the king of the north, that would be Antiochus III, will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city, that'd be Sidon. The force of the south will be powerless to resist, so Ptolemy can't stop this. Even their best troops will have no strength to stand. So Ptolemy takes his best general and sends him up to bring deliverance to one of their cities, the city of Sidon, and they're captured and put in prison. So even Ptolemy's best troops are being defeated. The invader, Antiochus III from the Seleucid, from the north, will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He'll establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. The beautiful land is Judah, or in Israel. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south, and he will give him a daughter in marriage. The king of the south will give his daughter in marriage to Antiochus III, and that daughter is Cleopatra I. There's going to be there's like 10 Cleopatras. He's going to try and marry into the line in order to overthrow his kingdom, but his plans will not succeed. When Cleopatra gets married in, she says, this is great. I love it up here in Syria. I'm no longer on my dad's side. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands. It will take many of them. So he comes down here, begins to take these cities here. Now, showing up right here at this time is, it says, but a commander will put an end to his insolence. And this commander is Linicus, I'm trying to remember his name, from the Roman. He's from one of the proconsuls of Rome, comes and says, stop attacking Egypt, and preserves it. After this, he'll turn back towards the fortress of his own country, but will stumble and fall. Now, what takes place here, because of all these wars, he has a war with Rome over here in Asia Minor. And what Rome does, when they defeat him, they say, you owe us for this war. Everything that we spent on this war, and this is an interesting way of fighting a battle. When they defeat the enemy, they say, you owe us for all of our war expenses. Interesting. You can see these people are taxing other countries for their war expenses. When they defeat a country, they say, you pay for the war. Well, now he's got to come up with all this money. So what Antiochus III does is he starts plundering temples, trying to get money to pay for the war he had with Rome, so they'll get off his back, which sets the stage. He's robbing a temple there in verse 19 and is killed robbing a temple in 187, which now sets up, notice right here, verse 20, his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he'll be destroyed. Heliodorus is the tax collector. He's actually sent down to Jerusalem to plunder the temple in Jerusalem because these guys like Jason tell him there's gold in the temple. And Heliodorus comes down to get it. And there's a story, an account, we'll talk about it next week, where as he's trying to approach the temple to get the gold, some kind of horses appear and chase him out of the temple. Is it a true story? Is it just a Jewish legend? But Heliodorus doesn't get the gold at that time, and it's protected. Onias III is the priest right before Jason comes over, and the gold is preserved. I got to tell you that story again next week and get those things kind of straightened out. Boy, that's tough stuff to teach through. I'm going to pray and hope you come back. Hey, thank you. Father, we do thank you so much for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we may make sense of all these things. We thank that you are the God who controls history. We do again thank you for the chance to meet here. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Any questions? As if you understood any of that. Okay, next year. All right. Hey, thanks for coming. Oh, hey. And no one stole my coins. Thank you.